start today the Torah way on Tes Zayin Av Tovshin Pei, 6th of August. This is Rabbi Amram Nemeth, and the topic is Sir Moses Montefiore, the challenges then and the challenges now. This year has been broadcasted live out of Sir Moses Montefiore's shul in Ramsgate on his yard site. Okay, Bershus. The trustees, Rabbi Dr. Abraham Levy, Lucien Gabay, who run the Montefiore Endowment. We thank them for the permission they've granted to use this shul on the Nachla'a. On the yacht, can I ask you just not to move because there's a very bad echo and they won't hear very well. On the yacht site, of Rav Moshe Montefiore, of Sir Moses Montefiore, and we're here in Ramsgate broadcasting the shir. And I don't want to talk to you today as a historian, because that may be an insult to him. I could talk to you about how he made so much money, but if I knew, then I don't think I would be here giving this shir today. Rather, I'd be making it myself. However, this morning, I want to talk to you from a place of Hakoras HaToiv and gratitude to him. Because for 5 years now, I have been supported by the Montefiore Endowment to teach Torah, to learn Torah, and to study in depth. And they've sponsored that, not only myself, but many of my friends and colleagues as well. And this has been going on more recently since 2006. And originally, the Koilel and the college was started in memory of his wife, Lady Judith, in 1860. Over here in Ramsgate. So that's a long time. Therefore, a lot of Hakoras HaToiv that we owe to him in order to pay him back for, so to speak, what he's given us. So today is Nachla'a in his yacht site. I want to give you just maybe a small window into his life and share with you some of the challenges he had, similar to the challenges that we have. And it will shed some light into why we're here today and what the kind of person that he was. And the subjects that we're going to cover are Teshuvah, our Eretz Yisrael, and Chinuch and Bitachon. And we're going to look at that through the lens of the life of Sir Moses Montefiore. So it was a high-end event in Japan, sorry, in Buckingham Palace. This is how the legend goes. And a man sat next to Montefiore and he said to him, obviously didn't like him or his people, and he said, "I've just come from Japan where there are no pigs and no Jews. And that's why I love it so much there, because it's clean of both." And so Montefiore turned to him and said, "Well, accordingly, we should both go, so they should have one of each." Now, I don't know if that story is true. That's a legend attributed to him. But there are many, many stories that show his Mesiras Nefesh and dedication to Kashrus in particular. In times when it was extremely challenging to keep it, to be mixing with the high and mighty and the high chafens, and to be mixing with them, and to be careful to have the higher standard of Kashrus nowadays, is mainly under the... It's, I would say, easier. If you're going back 150 years ago, it's much harder. And he was appointed Sheriff of London. And people remembered him for arriving at his first dinner in his robes of office, holding a kosher chicken in his hand in preparation for the dinner. Now, Queen Victoria, whose relationship of friendship with Montefiore, I'm sorry, we will discuss later, invited him to dinner at the palace. And she always liked to honor her guests with a side of venison. This story I heard from Rabbi Levy. And so Montefiore arranged for the shochet, or the shochet, from Bevis Marks to go to Richmond to shecht a deer to enable him to have kosher food in the banquet in the palace. And these stories are plentiful. These are only just a few. And many people, read these stories and understand and get inspired by them. But in my humble opinion, as I say, not a historian, but just from reading a fair amount about him, I think there's a backstory to this. And there's a backstory to his dedication to Kashrus, I would say, in particular, because that's what we have the most stories about. Him going to many high-end events and sort of, to an extent, embarrassing himself. I think in the City Hall, he was known for his beef, his cold beef that used to arrive in, and everyone used to try and take a piece of it and laugh at him a bit. Obviously, it was done in good humor to an extent, but these things are hard to keep 150 years ago, and there's so many stories of them. And he didn't go to yeshiva. He didn't have an education that we have had today, or many of us anyway. And interestingly, if you look at the diary of not him, but of his parents, so Monte Fiori was born in Livorno in 1784. It's a port town in Italy, originally called Leghorn. And we've discussed the Prichadash in this year in the Torah raid 2 years ago. And the Prichadash lived in Livorno for a bit. And the Chidah was originally buried there. It was a place where, you know, the Yid and the Jews were enabled to practice their religion freely. They were able to also take part in the commerce in the port. I think it was known for being closed on Shabbos because there were so many Yidden that were involved with the stevedores and bringing the boats in and out. And the Montefiores at that point in 1784 had branches in London and in Livorno too. And his father, Joseph Elias, married Rachel Mercata, another prestigious family from the Sephardi elite in London. And I read you some of Rachel's diary just after she'd given birth to Sir Moses on the way from Livorno to London, and there was a lot of travel between the two. And this, I would say, is a backstory and the start to Montefiore's dedication. So I'm going to read you a diary from his mother. On our return journey to England during a severe winter, I was unwilling to entrust him to a stranger. Now you're allowed to give a, halakhically, you're allowed to give a baby to be fed by a non-Jewish wet nurse. But I didn't want to. We find a similarity in the Gemara in Sotah with Moshe Rabbeinu, as I briefly mentioned before Pesach on this program as well. Moshe Rabbeinu, as we know in the Pasuk, right? He refused to go to anyone else but his mother. I'm not trying to come Moshe Oy without comparing the two, but we find such a precedent. I acted myself as his nurse, and many a time I felt the greatest discomfort through not having more than a cup of coffee and bread and butter on the ship for weeks on end. No meat of any description passed my lips, my husband and myself being strict observers of the ritual instructions as to diet. Okay, so she was makbid on the kashrus. But more importantly, later when she arrived, she writes, I feel at present the greatest satisfaction in account of my having strictly adhered to what I thought was correct. So not only was she moisa nefesh, did she give herself over to keep kashrus, the mother, but she was happy to do it. And she was happy to keep the principles that she was brought up with, even when it was difficult. And I would guess, and I would say, that it was by no mere chance or fluke that throughout Montefiore's life, he was challenged so many times with keeping kashrus, by having been part of so many banquets and events. And he always asked in every country that he was, whether it was Jewish people who weren't religious or offered him non-kosher food, or whether it was goyim who offered him non-kosher food. He always kept to it, but it started somewhere. And it shows how powerful, I think, as parents, what we have the ability to overcome temptations, to overcome nisyonos, and that goes automatically into our children, and it keeps them strong to keep into the principles forevermore. And he had a difficult life in doing that. So I would say there's a backstory, and I would suggest maybe that's one of the backstories to it. It didn't come by fluke. Now, as I said, I'm not going to discuss his business this morning because I wouldn't be here and I don't have much of an understanding of it. He did well in the stock exchange. He was the brother-in-law of Nathan Rothschild, which obviously helped him a lot. But at the height of his career, at 40, his heart was already elsewhere. And he quotes in his diary to Tehillim, Ve'enesh kechatzah yamav, similar to the pasuk we say on Yom Kippur, right? A man's life is like a fleeting dream. Is this what it's all about? Making more and more millions and millions and millions the whole time? Is there nothing else to it? And it's at that point where he starts to sort of semi-retire from the city life and he buys East Cliff Lodge just behind here, which is by and large knocked down now, where you can see the facade of the entrance to it as you come into King George Park. And he builds a beautiful shul here, as you can see, built by his cousin, Mokata. And he arranges for a minyan. There's no college or koilel here yet. That comes 30 years later in memory of his wife. But he's sort of moving away from making more and more money, and the lesson he's taking for himself is life's got to be much more spiritual than that. And then the legends abound. You know, one year, we always do an event here on the yacht side. We don't normally have the opportunity to live stream it. But we learn different sugyas here. After Shachris, we have a breakfast here in the garden, which is on the left of the shul here. And then we learn for an hour and a half. And one year we learned the sugya of making a bracha on a king, because we felt that was the most relevant to Montefiore's life. And the Gemara in Brachas tells us a couple of times, La'olam yaretz lefnei malcha Yisrael, she'em yizke yavchen. A person should always try and run before a king. And the Gemara even discusses transgressing an Issa d'Rabbanon to do so. Because if you do so, you'll be able to contrast the Malchei almost La'olam to the Melech HaMashiach, which will come in Mitzvah Hashem. You'll have an idea of what it means to be a king. And if there's anyone who met kings and dignitaries and important parliamentary figures, it was him. And if there's any religious Jew who met many important figures, that it was him. In England anyway. And there are many... Queen Victoria came to Ramsgate, which was then a fashionable resort. And she came as a young girl, as a princess. And this is documented that he gave her a golden key. And she writes in her diary, I think many years later, she had a house in Ramsgate nearby, or a member of her family did. I don't recall exactly who it was. And she used to stroll in the garden in her older years, though not necessarily when she was young. And Rabbi Levy, who's the principal of the Montefiore College, he was having dinner in Buckingham Palace, and he mentioned this to Queen Elizabeth, and he said there's a golden key which was given by Moses Montefiore to Queen Victoria in order to enable her to walk around in the garden, and she said, we must find it. But they never actually did, and I think it's Rabbi Morris from the Bevis Mark Shul who pursued the matter, and they showed him, and the palace showed them a number of golden keys, and they located the one, and as far as I understand, it's now in Bevis Marks. And there's a very famous story with Rabbi Ader, the chief rabbi of London, together with Montefiore and Queen Elizabeth when she was in Hamburg in Germany. And she was, she didn't realize she was going to go into labor so early, and she was 7 months pregnant, and you know, the baby was ready to come. And apparently there was a problem in the succession. If the baby would have German citizenship, then Edward wouldn't be able to be the king. So the legend goes, and in the book, which is very reliable, written by Abigail Green, she said she asks Beryl Futterfuss, I think he's a Yid in Stamford Hill, he told her this part of the story, an old Russian Yid, and he relayed this to her. That in Hamburg there was, you know, the Queen Montefiore was there at the same time, and Queen Victoria was there, and the court and the palace, they realized they had this problem, that she was about to give birth. And Montefiore went to Mincha Maariv, and Rabbi Adler was then living in Germany. And so he explained, and Rabbi Adler told Montefiore, well, if she goes on a boat a few miles off the coast and she has it on a British warship, then she'd be considered to be having it on British soil. And the succession for Edward would be easier. And she did, and she was ever indebted, and people say that's why she encouraged Rabbi Adler to come over and be the chief rabbi. She supported it years later. Now, there's definitely some part of that story is true. The problem is, we look at the dates. Montefiore at that time was in Egypt pleading on behalf of a blood libel, which moves us on to the next part of Montefiore's life. He was, I think, at best, call it one of the biggest askanim we've had. And that was at the time where people started approaching people from different countries to help them. And Britain was at the height of the empire, so he had the backing of Queen Victoria and the British government. And so he was a Yid that so many people turned to. And if you're here, we would show you outside. There's a book that Lucien Gabay put together of all the letters from Gedolim, the Tzadiger Rebbe, Rebbes and Rosh Hashivas, appealing to Montefiore to help them from across Europe and across the world. And at that time, the date of the story where he was apparently helping King Edward achieve his succession to the throne, they say, although one can't rely so much on the diaries either, he was in Damascus. And what was he doing there? There was a blood libel. And they'd arrested many of the Jews, and they were torturing many of the Jews to admit that they had killed a monk in order to use the blood for matzahs or for ritual purposes. And it was a terrible, terrible situation. All the Jews were scared to come out of the houses. And this story went across the world, and eventually the Board of Deputies in London sent Montefiore, together with, I think you pronounce his name, Adolphe Cremieux. Now, there was a lot of politics between the French and the English going to save this case. Like any Asconis that we do, you know, people will always be trying to take the credit. And it went well, this story. They saved, although there was many problems with it, the Jews were released from prison, and they managed to, you know, have a normal life afterwards. But he said Montefiore took the credit, and it was the French that really did it. And it goes to show that these things are always going to be the same. And there'll always be people who take credit or who give credit or who say it was me. And they had if you read the diaries, there was a very, you know, we look at something afterwards, we see a beautiful story. But the nitty-gritty of the Damascus blood libel, when they were staying together every single day, of who would go to the Pasha, who would go to Muhammad Ali, who would send back the news report, who wouldn't, was fraught with friction. And it's inevitable. I mean, it's something which, you know, if you're doing something so important, and it's gonna, I think that would be slightly inevitable. But then he was in Damascus, and it moves us on to the next part of his story, where he's pleading on behalf of Yidden worldwide. There was the Mutara affair, where sadly a young 8-year-old boy apparently was baptized by his nanny and cleaner and taken to live with the church. And that story didn't go well. He never came back. Which is also important to remember as well. That we look at all the successes that he had many, many, many failures too. I want to just move on to, I think, the most important part, and this will move on to a small amount of halacha. Montefiore traveled to Eretz Yisrael, I think, 7 times in his life. And he had a passion that I think, especially in that time, was unmatched. And I'd like to read you also some parts of his diary that show an unbelievable kesher and connection that he had to Eretz Yisrael that I think so many of us just dream of. And we don't even get near to this level of connection when we arrive there in Tel Aviv. And it started here. I've mentioned this before, so I'll mention this briefly, because we've given a few Torah shiurim, but I've mentioned always 1 or 2 minutes of history about Montefiore before. But he had a dream. Eliyahu HaNavi came to him and pointed towards Yerushalayim. And him and his, sadly, as we're going to see in a minute, his wife didn't have any children, so they had time to travel. And they took the tremendously difficult trip to go to Israel then, and to Eretz Yisrael. And he brought, you know, it became a thing. He brought many people's money. It wasn't always his own money. He brought Judah Toro's money. He was, you know, he collected funds from other people and took it to Eretz Yisrael to help the Yidden and the old Yishuv. And elsewhere, he tried to give them jobs and parnasa. And he put his heart and soul into it. And, you know, if we look at the diary of his first night in Eretz Yisrael, he writes, he got up at 2 o'clock in the morning to daven and to learn the rest of the night. This is someone who, you know, didn't learn Gemara much, but he knew how to learn Chumash, he knew how to daven. And if you see the tshuva that brought around, and we say in this week's parasha, in parashas Ekev, Eretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Doresh Oisa Tomid, Eini Hashem Elokecha Ba, that the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu are much more concentrated than the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, according to the Rabbeinu Bechai, is much more concentrated and involved in the intimate affairs of everyone there when you live in Eretz Yisrael. And clearly, this is not legend, this is not something that's a fairy tale that's come, this is written in his diary, and clearly he felt that. And we're not talking about the Hasidic Rebbe, we're not talking about a Rosh Yeshiva, as we'll see soon from Rav Moshe Feinstein. We're talking about a very special Yid, a very special Jew, who was devoted to helping other Jewish people completely, who gave over millions of his own money to other people. But still, he wasn't what we would call a gadol, but he felt a connection to Eretz Yisrael clearly that I think much more than I've ever felt, and I think many of us. And when he came, he writes afterwards that from now on he's going to be careful to daven with the minyan, to hear Kriyas HaTorah. I mean, just because he felt the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Eretz Yisrael, and interestingly, not so connected, he doesn't write this himself, but if you look at the diaries later, you see, when they went to Eretz Yisrael the second time, on the same routes as the first one, he bemoans the fact that there's no minyan and no shul in this town. And he never wrote that by the first one. So Eretz Yisrael caused him, clearly, to have a massive internal tshuva, and to come back to the ways of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the pasuk in this week's parsha, Eretz Asher Hashem Elokecha Dorish Oisa Tamid. It's a place where Hashem's presence is closer. But how many of us feel that at all when we arrive at Ben Gurion? To stay up the whole night suddenly davening to Hashem, and to take on that from now your life will be more careful, more medaktik by mitzvahs, more medaktik with tefillah, with tzibor, more medaktik with everything, because you've arrived in Eretz Yisrael. I think that's unbelievable. And that shows the kind of person that he was. You know, I think to have those kind of sentiments, as well as the fact that he helped Yidden across the world, as well as the fact that he was careful with kashrus, I think the fact that, you know, he had such a kashrus towards Eretz Yisrael, which is unmatched, that makes it us worth doubling by his kaver today. And, you know, this is not brought in the book, but I think, you know, there's a lot of articles about this, that when Montefiore came past Kaver Rachel, his wife was very inspired, because sadly she didn't have any children. And he bought Kaver Rachel back from the Arabs, and the Yidden owned it, and he, you know, he arranged that there'd be a dome on top with the pictures that we know it before it was built now. The famous postcard pictures of Kaver Rachel with the dome and the Yidden going in, that was him. And he built that. And therefore, when he came back and his wife passed away, then you'll look next door, and over here we have the mausoleum was built based on what Kaver Rachel looked like. Because that's a place that that's a place that his wife was attached to. And he built in 1869 the Montefiore College, and the Montefiore College in memory of her, which was just over here in the buildings next to the synagogue. Now we have a few more minutes. In 1927, the Rosh Kollel and the leader of the Kollel was Rav Shem Tov Sanguin, author of a famous sefer called Kesa Shem Tov, who lived here and who led the Kollel over here just on the left. And the buildings sadly were demolished, I think, in the 50s and 60s. We were here a few years ago with the Ravram Gorovitz, and his wife was telling us that the Lopians used to enjoy spending their holidays there when the buildings, I think, were still intact. But sadly, they're all knocked down now, so you can't see the place of the Kollel. But Rabbi Yom Tov Sanguin in 1927, Rabbi Shem Tov Sanguin, he was the Rosh Kollel, and he led the Kollel, and he was a big Talmid Chacham. And he discusses the importance of being buried in Eretz Yisrael, but obviously that, you know, that predates him. Yaakov asked, take my bones to Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe was busy taking the Atzmas Yosef when all Klal Yisrael were taking the money from Mitzrayim and becoming wealthy. He was, Rashi says, busy with the mitzvah of taking the bones of Yosef in order to bury them in Eretz Yisrael. And Chazal are repeating telling us all the advantages of being buried in Eretz Yisrael. That person has a kapara for any of the averas that he may have done during his lifetime. And therefore there was a discussion, not entirely based on the Torah, but for many other political maybe considerations as well, to move Montefiore's kaver from here to Eretz Yisrael and to Yerushalayim. And that prompted a big machloikas in the Poskim. And I'm not going to give a psak, well, they're still here anyway, but that's for many other considerations too. But I just want to share with you before we stop the two shittas that were in the Poskim with regards to moving Montefiore and his wife's kaver to Yerushalayim. They're here in the middle of Ramsgate. And the people who come here in the summer, but generally speaking, no one's here the whole year, or maybe every few weeks there's someone who comes here, but, you know, they're not really heard of. And they were choshuva people. And there were two shittas. Rabbi Avadia Yosef wrote to the Beis Din in London that they should be moved. It's important to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. And who more than Montefiore in his time valued and cherished Eretz Yisrael? And if he would have had the opportunity, of course he would have wanted that. And halachically, although you can't move a kaver, you can't move it at all, you can move it to Eretz Yisrael. And even if, I think that the Poskim say in the Shulchan Aruch, I don't remember who it was exactly, that even if the parent didn't specifically request move me to Eretz Yisrael, as long as they had nothing against it, you can move it, although it's very difficult to move a kaver, because of the zechus and the merit of being buried in Eretz Yisrael. So Rav Avadia Paskin, you should definitely move him, and his wife as well. And interestingly, he brings there that the Chida, who we mentioned at the beginning of this shiur, who lived in Livorno, was buried in Livorno and moved to Eretz Yisrael. But that wasn't taken on by all the Poskim at all. And Rav Moshe Feinstein argued for two reasons why that shouldn't be correct. First of all, who would be moving the cave to Eretz Yisrael? It wouldn't be his children, because sadly he had no children. So it would be us. It would be Klal Yisrael thing that for the covet of this person, for what he did for Eretz Yisrael, for what he did for the Eden and the old Yishuv of Meir Sha'arim and everywhere else in Yerushalayim, we're going to move him. But says Rav Moshe Feinstein, he wasn't a gadol though. He wasn't a Talmud Chacham. So what you're doing is, you're saying that he's more important than all the gadolim buried in Europe now. If it's a child doing it, then a child is doing that for their parent. A child is not doing that for Klal Yisrael. Therefore, it's understood a child may want to move their parents' kever to Eretz Yisrael. But here, it's Klal Yisrael doing it for Chashuva people in Klal Yisrael. So says Rav Moshe in his very small tshuva, written, I think, to Rabbi Jacobson in London. I don't know who that is. Yitzchak Jacobson. I don't know who that is exactly. He says, so Klal Yisrael are caring for the kavod of Montefiore and therefore will move the Kaaba. What about all the kfarim tours we do in Europe? Well, the Bach, everyone. Let's move them all. All the Hasid Rebbes that we know, all the Litvashev Gdolim that we know, the kfarim tours that we go on. We should move everyone. And says Rav Moshe Feinstein, no one's going to argue the work Montefiore did for Klal Yisrael and for everyone. But he wasn't a godder. And you can't compare him to the other gadolim that we have. And therefore, why would you move him and not them? And therefore, it would be against their covet. And it wouldn't be respectful to them. Which is a very interesting response. And second of all, he said, because he knew about Eretz Yisrael, he could have moved there towards the end of it. He could have moved there towards the end of his life in order to enable himself to be buried there. And therefore, he passed, he should leave him exactly where he is, and therefore he's still here now. Well, at least we in England have the opportunity to daven by his kever and to make a minyan here on his yahrzeit. So I hope I've given you just a glimpse. I mean, the amount that's written on Montefiore is just endless. A glimpse into his life, and we've learnt, I think, from the challenges that he had, and that's hopefully inspired us to an extent, of kashrus, of Eretz Yisrael, of trusting Hashem in difficult times. And then finally we left off with the argument between the poskim about whether his kever should be moved. And Rav Avadia says, yes, of course. And who less than the Chida, who was buried in Livorno in Montefiore's hometown, was moved to Eretz Yisrael. So we should definitely move. And he quotes all the Gemaras and the Mari Chazal and the Pesukim of Yaakov and Yosef, that obviously it's important that it gives someone a kapara of being buried in Eretz Yisrael and move him to Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe Feinstein said, no. Because why are you putting him above all the other gedolim buried in Europe and the rest of the world? Why is he bigger than them? He definitely isn't. And therefore, if you're going to move him, if Klal Yisrael is going to take a part in moving him, then Klal Yisrael has to move everyone. If a child moves a parent, that's a family thing. It's not a Klal Yisrael project. However, this is Klal Yisrael taking care, therefore we should all do it. And second of all, he says, who knew more than him about Eretz Yisrael? So why didn't he request to be buried there? Why didn't he go and live there in his old age? That's what he says. And if as much as we should come and give him covered, we shouldn't move it. So this chus should be a melech yosha for him. It should be his chus for us. Next year with Hashem, we should be with his kever, but in Yerushalayim, with all of us together. We should be zocher to see Mashiach, as a kenim, and have your main, our main. Shkoyach, thank you. Shkoyach.